from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro, in for Michael Krasny. Robin Williams, one of the reigning gods of comedy, has left us at the age of 63. He was a stand-up comedian first, before he was a TV and movie star, but he never left the stage and often performed here in the Bay Area while working out routines for broader consumption. Many comedians consider Robin Williams one of their formative inspirations, a master of rapid-fire accent and personality changes, scandalously intelligent and profane at the same time, and for that matter, many of the rest of us consider him a formative inspiration too. We'll be taking your calls and talking to people who knew him and worked with him here in the Bay Area. That's coming up in this hour of Forum. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro, in for Michael Krasny. Asking a person which Robin Williams performance is your favorite is really ridiculous. Mork and Mindy, The World According to Garp, Good Morning Vietnam, Dead Poets Society, The Fisher King, Aladdin, Mrs. Doubtfire, Flubber. His many, many stand-up routines, covering everything from politics to pot to prostate exams. There's a part of Robin Williams in all of us, and his passing requires a fulsome discussion of the artist and the man. That's going to include a range of people who knew him and worked with him in the Bay Area, and it's going to include you. Call us at 866-733-6786. We very much want to hear from listeners of KQED's Forum to tell us what Robin Williams meant to you, how he's affected your life, memories that you might have. 866-733-6786. And of course, you can always email us at forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and add your comments and questions there. We're going to start this morning with Leonard Maltin on the phone, film critic, historian, best-selling author. His 2014 movie guide is now available online, and he writes regularly about movies at leonardmaltin.com. Thank you so much for talking with us.
And of course.
Well, this is a hard moment.
Oh, when I got the call yesterday with the news, I was, like so many people, I'm sure, I was just devastated. Devastated. Because I was a fan, an admirer, and I had talked to him many times over the years. So on every level, I was just shocked and dismayed.
What was your first interaction with him as a consumer of his comedy?
As a consumer, let's see. Well, it was probably either Mork and Mindy or an early special he did for HBO that I remember that he did here in Los Angeles, I think at the Roxy, an hour of stand-up and improv. Just overpowering is the word that comes to mind. It was overpowering.
It was like his genius was coming out of a fire hose.
A fire hose that had been punctured with a lot of little holes so that there was spray coming in every direction. I'd never seen anything quite like him before. I guess many of us could say the same. And, of course, I was also a fan of his idol, Jonathan Witters. But even Jonathan Witters, who was a genius in his own right, wasn't as lightning quick as Robin, I think.
You know, while a lot of that genius came out in its top form on stage, you do get to see it in the movie Good Morning Vietnam, and we just have to play a clip from that right away, because it's where you see that manic energy delivered best.
Good morning, Vietnam! Hey, this is not a test. This is rock and roll. Time to rock it from the Delta to the DMZ. Is that me, or does that sound like an Elvis Presley movie? Viva Da Nang. Oh, viva Da Nang. Da Nang me, Da Nang me. Why don't they get a rope and hang me? Hey, is it a little too early for being that loud? Hey, too late. It's 0600. What's the O stand for? Oh, my God, it's early. Speaking of early, how about that Cro-Magnon Marty Drywitz? Thank you, Marty, for silky smooth sound. Make me sound like Peggy Lee. Freddie and the Dreamers.
O is for early. You know, it's never too early for me. I got to say, every morning when I get into the studio at 5:20 a.m., the first words out of my mouth when that, you know, live mic light goes on, it's Good Morning Vietnam.
Well, you know, that was one of his earlier films and a great vehicle for him, just a perfect vehicle for him. But he had so many. When you scan over that list of films he made, and it's dozens of movies, it's such a wide variety, such a staggering variety of roles and of I was just thinking about this morning. If you had said to me 35 years ago when he first came on the scene that someday he would wind up portraying Dwight D. Eisenhower and Theodore Roosevelt in movies, I would have said nonsense. But he did both of those things. He played Eisenhower in Lee Daniels The Butler last year, and he played Teddy Roosevelt in the Night at the Museum movies, and did them well.
He did Sirius very well. You know, he was deeply affecting in so many movies. Pulling back on that manic energy, I'm thinking, The Fisher King, Awakenings. These were really moving performances.
Absolutely, and I think that, I mean, number of comedians have turned out to be very good dramatic actors as well. I think what was surprising in his case was that his comedy was so manic and so freeform that you didn't think somehow he could harness it for dramatic purposes, but of course he could. And remember, too, that he attended, the first graduating class at Juilliard when they opened an acting school in New York decades ago, and when it was being run by John Houseman. That's where he met Christopher Reeve, and they remained, lifelong friends. Sad to think that they're both gone now.
You know, one expects after a great man passes that for a lot of people to, deliver glib sadness, small comments on Twitter about how they're sorry he's gone. But he really had a reputation for being a lovely, lovely guy.
Well, he was lovely to me every time I met him. And it was numerous occasions, for both formal interviews and casual chats. He was funny, but he could also be very thoughtful and serious, and he knew when to be serious. The first time I interviewed him was when he was promoting the movie Awakenings, which was a serious film. But he knew that, for a show like Entertainment Tonight, for which I was working at the time, it was important to be serious about the film and still be entertaining as an interviewee. And he managed to do that. He could do that. He could turn on a dime. And so he was never inappropriate. He was very solid. He had good sensibilities in that sense.
Given your breadth, just thinking in terms of film criticism, I'm wondering if you can talk about one or two of his lesser-known performances, stuff that we should make sure to put on our Netflix list
for the next week.
There
are two that I'd recommend. I mean, they're not everybody's taste, I know, because they're dark and offbeat, but the two that I write about on my website today are World's Greatest Dad, which came out in 2009, written and directed by Bobcat Goldthwait, which is a very dark social satire / black comedy, where he plays a failed writer who's now a school teacher who has got quirky relationships with everyone around him, including his son, and a tragedy in his life gives him a chance to get the notoriety he's always dreamed of, and he seizes the opportunity, for better or worse. And then there's a film I like very much called One Hour Photo, came out in 2002, where he plays, of course, this dates it, of course, but he plays a guy at a photo developing counter at a department store who takes a more than casual interest in his customers. And he winds up being kind of a creepy guy, but believably creepy. And those are two of my favorite performances of his from a more serious point of view. But there's very little he did that I didn't like.
I think that's probably true for a lot of people. Let's turn to the phones now. And Chris in San Francisco.
Hi. I was at College of Marin with Robin and did shows with him. And as a measure of his versatility, when he did Fiddler on the Roof, 250 people auditioned. And not only did he play Perchik the Student, but he was one of the four bottle dancers at the wedding. And, when they did the show, they had hats and they weighted the bottles and all that. But there was a wedding in the production, and during the reception, they started playing the wedding music. So they kind of went into the dancing from the wedding and everything. And Robin and the other three bottle dancers started doing the bottle dance with just champagne bottles on their plain heads. And he was the only one that made it through without the bottle falling off. So a lot of people realize what a good dancer he was.
Fiddler on the Roof, Leonard Maltin. I'm just thinking, what a loss that we never got the chance to see him play the role of Tevye. Could you just imagine how much he'd rock that?
You know, there was nothing he couldn't do. He was a good singer, and I've just now learned he was a good dancer. He was the ultimate performer. I truly believe there was nothing he couldn't do.
Well, Leonard Maltin, thank you so much for talking with us from Los Angeles this morning. A pleasure.
Thank you very much for having me.
So we have a couple of folks on the phone today who have some experience. Bob Sarlat came up together with Robin Williams. He's an actor and a comedian, frequently appears on The Late Show with David Letterman, a longtime field announcer for the San Francisco 49ers. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, how are you this morning? It's a tough couple of days, but I like your show. I thought Leonard was wonderful just then. That was great.
Oh, thank you. And joining you now, we've got Jeff Bolt, an actor, writer, and comedian, and friend of Robin Williams. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. And Bob, how are you?
I'm doing great, Jeff. Jeff and I go back, as you might guess, it's kind of a small community here, so we we all know each other. You know, the comedy community is pretty incestuous here.
Well, you know, there's so many people. Forum spoke just a few days ago to Greg Proops, famous for Whose Line Is It Anyway, among many other things. And he was just pointing out, like, for many, many comics, either who are in the San Francisco Bay Area or pass through at some point, Robin Williams was a godfather.
Well, you know, I kind of came up with him in, like, 1976 in the first San Francisco comedy competition that was held in a very small little place called Joe Nebrika Showcase on Franklin Street. And we all did comedy sets, you know, for a couple of weeks together. The comedy competition is a sort of a round robin kind of a thing. And I got to know Robin very well during that time. And, you know, he was always everywhere. I think the interesting thing, I think Jeff might agree with this. It's funny, you don't think of him as a legend because he's a friend of yours, but, I mean, this story is tremendously huge. It's not that I didn't expect it to be, but we keep forgetting that in our parents' eyes, people like Jack Benny, Bob Hope, were big deals, and to a certain extent we knew them too. But Robin is every bit their equal, or maybe usurps that, and it was just hard to fathom it when it's right in front of your face all the time, you know?
I have to agree with Bob on that. I'm just in shock, and he's all over the news. I saw somebody from France talking about what a hero he is over there, but to us, I saw him just a couple, 3 weeks ago at a little potluck barbecue locally. I mean, he was just a pal, a buddy, a good friend. He was everywhere, and if you were doing a show or something, you'd halfway expect him to show up because he'd generally be there. If there was a stage and a place to perform in front of people, he would be there and enhance your show if you were doing it. So really, we lost a good friend, and he was a good friend to all the comedians, and he was just so kind and generous to every young comedian and helpful, and yeah, he was a sweet, sweet man. I'm sure he knew Bob's kids. He knew my kids by name and talked to my kids on the phone. And he was just a great guy.
Jeff Bolt, did you have any sense, having seen him about 3 weeks ago, that he was struggling, that he wasn't doing well?
You know, we actually, when he came back from Canada, I thought he had lost some weight. And so we talked about his health a little bit. And he mentioned that he had gone back to I guess Minnesota for this tweaking, as he called it, and I had not noticed any reoccurrence of any drugs or alcohol or anything like that. But he seemed a little subdued. He was actually more outgoing. He was very friendly, and my daughter was there, who he had spoken with on the phone once. We were outside the Throckmorton Theater in Mill Valley, and I was talking to my daughter, who was in New York at the time, getting her PhD, and she was having a mood swing whether to stay in New York and was it worth it and what a struggle it was. And I just handed the phone to Robin. I said, here, you talk to her. And he just scolded her and prodded her and teased her. And they both giggled. And you stay in school. You're going to be a doctor. You're going to do it. And she's now working up here in Biomarin. with her PhD and whatnot. But he was all over the place. Had I noticed anything? Not really. No. I mean, I just it was pretty normal. He was just very chatty, very sweet, and just a nice guy. Yeah.
Now, I understand, Jeff, that you were with Robin Williams in the movie Mrs. Doubtfire.
I think Bob was in Flubber.
Bob was in Flubber.
Yeah, this is something about
Flubber,
Robin.
As a basketball coach, and but you know what? I know to Jeff's point, there were a lot, and this was talked about also a number of times, Jeff, and in the last day here, is that you know he got a lot of people local work on shows like Mrs. Doubtfire, and I know that you and Michael and Dick Bright and a lot of our friends were in that film, and he always shot his movies up here, which was sort of a little bow to his friends up here, I think, a little bit, which was.
Do you think
nice.
In part he wanted to make sure some of his friends got some paying gigs?
Yeah, well, you know, I know, for example, I heard Terry McGovern, a mutual friend of Jeff's and mine and others, a longtime media guy here in the city, he made it a point to say that Mrs. Doubtfire was the best gig he ever had because it's probably the most popular rented movie, or it's the most shown on Netflix, most shown on cable. So there was a lot of great residual money coming out of that movie that doesn't always come out of movies that are made here. So he was the gift that kept on giving for a lot of people, you know?
Well, just to jog people's memories, we've got a lovely clip from that now.
I do voices.
What do you mean, you do voices?
Well, I do voices.
Yeah!
We've come to this planet looking for intelligent life. Oops, we made a mistake.
We're happy to be in America. Don't ask for a green card.
I want you in the worst way.
Well, this is certainly a rough meeting, and it's not going very well for me, I'll tell you that. Hey, boss, give it a chance. She's going to loosen up any moment.
Look at me right now, Moneypenny. I want to undo that bow and get to know you.
I'm crazy to make a deal with you.
Nancy and I are still looking for the other half of my head.
Idiot! You're doing it! I'm sitting on a gold mine!
Don't make me smack you, sweetheart. I'll do it. I do a great impression of a hot dog.
Only Robin Williams could do a great impression of a hot dog.
Seriously. Yeah, I've tried, and I'm terrible. And Bob, I know you know, that's
yes,
one of your calls.
By the way, it's interesting. I think Jeff's a great choice to be talking about this because he has a little bit more of the Robin bug than most in terms of improvisation and so there's a real affinity between you two guys, I think, in terms of, you know, about how you performed and how you guys could go on a dime off on some other tangent as opposed to most stand-ups. So Jeff is both an actor and an improv guy and a stand-up. So anyway, I just
well, that leads to my next question to Jeff Bolt, which is, you know, was Robin like this sort of off camera as well as on?
Backstage, just as sweet as can be. It didn't have to be the center of attention. On stage, he was sometimes a different story. He was, I worked with him hundreds of times on stage, as Bob said, and doing sketch comedy and whatnot. And he was tough to work with sometimes, but you'd do a scene with them. And he would come out on stage, and the audience would go nuts and would just go crazy, and he couldn't miss. He would, I think it might have been one of his chagrin, I don't know. He could get a laugh by just being on stage, and I think he found it frustrating because he would try to do a scene, a complete a sentence, and the audience would be just falling off their chairs.
Right. He was sort of preemptively laughing at whatever he was doing.
Yeah, it was just the audience knew he was going to be funny, and so he had a gift. He was great. Always not always on it, to answer your question. He was just always for the other comedians, for the people backstage, you could talk to him. Let's do this. Let's go out and do that. And he'd just be game for anything. And and then in the middle of a serious scene, break into song. He was.
You know what's funny, Jeff, when you were mentioning about when you were just being asked about if he was more subdued, it kind of a paradox. I found that he had been so much more mellower and so much, you know, than in his early years. I think he was really comfortable in his own skin more recently than he had been years before. It was always kind of tough to get him to be regular with you. I remember somebody asked me my favorite moments with Robin, and I said, well, they're the same favorite moments they would be with anybody when they were the most natural. And it was always hard in his early years to get him to sit down, have a glass of wine, talk a little bit, because he was, you know, he was always so frenetic. But in later years, I found him to be a lot more mellower off stage and able to do the things you were just saying, talking to your kids and doing all those kinds of things. I think that was more of an acquired skill with him over the years, you know?
Well, yeah, people are right. Oh, go ahead, Jeff.
No, I think Bob's probably accurate there. That's he has, as he aged and came around, he was just a lot more comfortable in his own skin.
He mellowed over the years
like
a fine wine. We're getting some lovely comments from people. Nicole emails, I'm surprised at how much Robin's passing brings me to tears. What a talent. I'm heartbroken by the sadness he must have been drowning in. He was sincerely loved. April posted on Facebook, as a kid, my brother wore his Mork suspenders daily. We heard he had a house in Santa Cruz where we lived. Not sure if it was true, but it made me feel as if he was ours, which I think most people in the Bay Area felt. He chose to live here and make movies here and engage with local causes. It's crushing to hear he took his own life, as I think we all thought of him as family.
Yeah, that I think that's true, and I he really didn't, and Bob can back me up on this. I mean, he talked about L.A. and how much he just liked it, and I think the Bay Area was a comfortable place for him. He wasn't followed by the paparazzi. I mean, he would show up. I mean, I remember seeing him just on the streets in, up here in Marin on his bicycle gear, and he'd stop in and run into him, have a cup of coffee, he'd sit there, and people didn't come up and bug him and just torment him like I think they do the, you know, Hollywood elite.
Celebrities are fair game in Los Angeles. Yeah,
and that just didn't happen up here. So it was always cautious. He was always cautious because there's always a... somebody...
Well, it can creep you out if strangers are coming up and thinking, you know, well, they know you better than you know them.
The media is very powerful, and, sometimes it just affects people differently, clearly, yeah. So...
I wanted to get one call in here before the bottom of the hour. Alethea in San Francisco. Hi there. Can you hear us, Alethea? Oh, I think we've lost her. She was going to say that she saw him when she was in school at Holy City Zoo. Does that raise any memories for either of you guys?
Well, the Holy City Zoo was the sort of seminal stand-up comedy club that we all played coming up. You know, everybody played for free. It originally started like a folk music club, like a New York club would be, and then they ended up having comedy on one night, two nights, and it became an all-comedy place, which was, you know, everybody would hang out there. And it was, and I think Jeff would attest to this, if you were doing sets in L.A. or at the Holy City Zoo, it was always so tough to follow Robin. I remember having to follow Robin at the Westwood Comedy Store one night, and it was just... You know, all of us could do pretty well on stage, but following Robin and the bedlam that Jeff was explaining, we're doing improv with him when he would just open his mouth and the place would go crazy.
I think I read this morning, just looking at broad coverage, the phrase, nobody follows Robin Williams.
Well, that's really true. It was, and it was just bad luck because of the Comedy Store.
Stay online, Bob. We're going to continue talking with you. We are talking about Robin Williams, the man, the comedian, the local who lived with us here in the Bay Area. Call us at 866-733-6786 to share your memories. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org or post online at kqed.org/forum. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Miro. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro. This hour, we're talking about Robin Williams, along with Jeff Bolt, actor, writer, and comedian, and friend of Robin Williams, as well as Willa Paskin, a television critic for Slate. Willa Paskin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, my goodness. I thought, just in starting to talk with you, that we might play a little clip from Mork and Mindy. Do you mind?
No, not at all.
Here we go.
It occurs to me we have not been formally introduced. A formal introduction is at hand. Get down. I am Mork from Mork. Nanu, nanu.
I'm I'm Mindy McConnell.
I like a being with a firm gribbit. Shows character, at least evolution.
Well, thank you. How do you say thank you in your language?
We spit.
Well, if anybody had a firm gribbit, it was Robin Williams. I'm wondering if you can talk about what a surprise this kind of performance was on television at the time.
Well, I mean, what's interesting is if you look at any episodes of Mark and Mindy, and they're actually mostly on YouTube, you can sort of just Google for them, you just see that he is Robin Williams, even in, you know, the late 70s on his first sort of starring role. He just has this energy, this kind of manic, hyper, really detailed sort of riffing that nobody has been, that's sort of inimitable, you know, and he had it sort of from the very start. When he got cast on Mark and Mindy, he had actually been, had a guest role in an episode of Happy Days. And at the end of the episode, where he played Mark. And at the end of the episode, it had been all supposed to be a dream, but he was so good at it that they ended up sort of, retroactively going back and pretending that Mork had just made everybody think it was a dream. You know, he was like that charismatic. They had to sort of change.
It was a cameo that became his breakout moment.
Yeah, and no one was sort of expecting it. And you know, honestly, in any episode of Mork and Mindy, you just see him doing these sort of bravura Robin Williams, these just like so distinctly Robin Williams-ish things that are so energetic and unique. And he just sort of came out of the box like that. So, you know, I'm reading Twitter last night. There was, I saw someone had tweeted that apparently the writers would like leave pages blank for, you know, Mork to just do his thing. And you can really see that in the show, where he just kind of goes on these amazing flights of fancy.
It's interesting to look back. I mean, in a time when it's become a cliche, comedians will basically do, you know, parallel versions of their own life in sitcoms. Robin Williams was able to be himself playing an alien in Rainbow Suspenders.
Totally right. It wasn't. It was not like loosely autobiographical in any way. And also, it's interesting as his career sort of went on, the things that he was doing in Mork and Mindy almost are probably more familiar to us who got to know the rest of his body of work than they were to people watching Mork and Mindy, where he must have seemed, you know, so, you know, really like an alien, like nobody was just doing what he was doing on that with that consistency, with that kind of energy.
He was trying to launch, or I guess it didn't work out, The Crazy Ones, another TV series that was going to co-star Sarah Michelle Gellar, but that was canceled.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Robin Williams obviously had a long career with a lot of movies that a lot of people love, but he also made a lot of movies that didn't do so well. And sort of that has been true in the last decade or so. And so like a lot of people, especially now that television has sort of become so much better and had this renaissance, he ended up on a TV show with David E. Kelly, who's, you know, the guy who made Ally McBeal, is a very big producer. And he was playing a very Robin Williams-y character. He was playing an ad executive who had, again, a huge amount of energy, did a lot of voices, was sort of like this impish, not always controllable character. It didn't, you know, the show aired last year. It never really quite gelled, but there was always, you know, these moments where he was, again, you know, Robin Williams just doing his thing and sort of blowing everybody else out of the water, which doesn't always maybe make for like a super balanced TV show, but could have these moments that were really, you know, hilarious and lively.
And it's fair to say, you know, dying on us at the tender age of 63, the public's appetite was not satisfied. We would have loved seeing him for a few decades more. Kathleen emails, thank heavens for Thursday nights watching Mork and Mindy. I struggled with life's trials and Robin got me through the week, every week. I got to thank Robin with a kiss at a rap party for helping me balance life from his gift of humor. I wish we could all give Robin a kiss and a hug to help him through life's trials too. Jeff Bolt, I'm just wondering, you know, from the benefit of your personal experience with Robin Williams, do you think he felt that people loved him as much as they did?
Oh, yeah, he did. I do think he was. It did affect him. Was it CBS that didn't pick the show up? I think those things did have taxed him in a sense. And I think he was down that show didn't do it to he had hoped it to do, and it wasn't received as in the public eye as much.
Nobody
as he
ever likes to be told no or slammed
yeah.
down.
And I think he did, as I think I mentioned that there was a couple of movies that hadn't done as well as they should have, and whatnot. Some of the scripts might not have been as good as. But to one thing to her point was the. Him being on and just giving Robin free rein. I was actually in the scene in Mrs. Doubtfire. We shot for 2 weeks at a restaurant in Danville, and I was the waiter that Robin had seen to that I got the part where I had a couple of speaking lines, just offering him the hard liquor on the one side when he was portraying Daniel Hilliard, and then he would run across the restaurant and he would be Mrs. Doubtfire before the big reveal at the end of the movie. There was 2 weeks to shoot that scene, and we would go 3-4 in the morning on this thing, 5 in the morning, because there was a 12-hour turnaround and 4 hours of costume change. So we would just shoot crazy, and there were of all the extras, all the people on that, we didn't lose a single soul in that restaurant. Everybody was there, and Robin would go on in between takes and just be entertain the troops and entertain everybody with his antics or him being Robin Williams, and have the entire cast and crew in hysterics for a grueling two straight weeks of shooting that one scene that probably took up about 5 minutes in the movie.
That was filmed at Bridges Restaurant in Danville, wasn't it?
It was. I think they're still there, as a matter of fact. And he just brought that whole town to life. But again, it was just remarkable that nobody, extras are not always treated very well. They were on this set, but 3-4 in the morning, back to set, and sit down in your chairs to stare across the table at the same person, you stranger who you've been staring at for 3 weeks, and to just to put up with that. And he was just he was great, and that was not an easy thing, because it was a full 4 hours, I think, in the makeup chair, putting all that garb on. And in the movie, you see him walk into the bathroom and then quickly walk out as Daniel Hilliard or vice versa. But no, that's not how it happened. That took that was the end of the shoot day when he was Mrs. Doubtfire. Then he'd come back the next day, he'd be Daniel Hilliard. So it's movie making is kind of a. It was all very interesting.
The rough side of it. I want to get back to your point, Willa Paskin, about, screenwriters, script writers leaving pages blank for Robin Williams to just fill in with whatever he felt like. And we've got a great clip from Aladdin. There was a movie, and, coming from a movie house that tends to like its stuff very carefully crafted, but they let Robin Williams rip, and rip he did.
10,000 years will give you such a crick in the neck. Hang on a second. Whoa! Wow! Does it feel good to be out of there? I'm telling you, nice to be back, ladies and gentlemen. Hi, where are you from? What's your name?
Aladdin.
Aladdin! Hello, Aladdin. Nice to have you on the show. Can we call you Al, or maybe just Din? Or how about Lobby? Sounds like, here, boy. Come on, Lobby.
God. I mean, it's not enough to say he was the best thing in that movie. He was the movie.
Yeah, I mean, he changed like the way that we cast animated films forever. He's the first celebrity, really like celebrity voice in a Disney movie. Now they all are. And it was because of the strength of that performance. I mean, like completely, totally made that having a non-visual speaking part in an animated movie a really big deal.
Beautiful point. Alex in Los Angeles, I understand you love Aladdin as well?
I think you brought up a really good point about him just making the movie. I'm turning 30 this month, and so I remember as a kid watching that movie, and it's really one of my favorite movies as a child. And I grew up with Robin Williams basically being a mainstay in my life. I mean, going from seeing him in those movies at that time, Mrs. Doubtfire, Aladdin, Jumanji as a kid, and then growing into seeing him in Good Will Hunting. And that movie really affected me because I'm adopted, and so that played kind of that movie was kind of a defining movie for me as well. And then I went off and I'm also a veteran, so I was in Iraq for a little while, and I came back and saw him in Bengal Tigers at a Baghdad zoo.
He did a lot of routines for soldiers out in the field, I know. Did you ever get a chance to see him?
No, unfortunately I didn't. I just think that would have been great, but I'm really glad I just happened to be in New York at the time that he was in that play, because it was really the only time I got to see him live, and I think that's because a lot of what he did live was kind of before my generation, before my time. But even then, I mean, that was just a couple years ago, and obviously, you know, I think close to 60 at the time, but his energy was captivating, and he made that play. He was the center of it, and everything he did was. And then to top it off, I recently personally was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and so it's just kind of like I've never really felt connected to a celebrity before, and he's one of the first to go, I think, in my life. That has really just been, I wouldn't say difficult, but it hit me. I mean, even recently when Philip Seymour Hoffman was passed away, that was pretty tough because he was so great. But Robin Williams was just something else. And
he was
I'm sure there are a lot of people
for a
my
lot of
age
people,
who
yeah.
would agree.
Well, if you ever did have a chance to talk to him or meet him backstage or something like that, I tell you, he would have sat and talked with you for a long time and just been a great guy. It's unfortunately you never got to meet him because he was just a sweet. Everything you say about him is true. I mean, he would have been your best friend. So don't mourn, but just turn to those old movies and he's still with us.
Thank goodness we have so much of him recorded. I mean, I still feel cheated by his death, but he did leave us with an incredible body of work that is a tremendous support. Thank you, Alex, for that story. I think you give voice to what a lot of people are feeling today and about how, you know, how supportive his performances are and life-saving in a way, the humor and the humanity. Thusi writes, Robin Williams is in a tradition of great humanists, there was not a mean or ungenerous bone in his comedy. The comedian Mark Maron did an incredible interview with Williams a few years back. Williams sounded utterly serene, speaking frankly of his experiences, including the substance abuse problems and subsequent cardiac issues. And then in the last few minutes, she says, Williams does a hysterical monologue describing how, even at his worst moments, he never seriously considered suicide. Well, we want to bring on the phone here now James Dunn, director of The Mountain Play. He founded the College of Marin's Drama Department, which he chaired from 1964 to 2003. Robin Williams was a student. James Dunn, thank you for joining the conversation.
Oh, thank you.
So, my goodness, what can you tell us about Robin Williams back in the day?
Well, I knew Robin Williams before he became Robin Williams, if you want to go that far. He was a student. He came to us from, he had been at the Redwood High School here in Marin County, and he had gone off to school in Southern California for a year or so, and then left school there. I think he was starting to be a political science major, and he decided that wasn't for him, and he came back, and he wandered into the College of Marin, and he came to an audition for a show. And the rest is kind of history. He was in the first show for me. It was a Shakespeare, Midsummer Night's Dream, and he was actually a spear carrier. He didn't have a line. He carried a spear, and I still have pictures of that. And then he started auditioning for all of the shows, and he was just really amazing. He played Fagin for me in Oliver, and I remember we were in our first dress rehearsal. It was, and things were going badly. We had a new light board, and the lights weren't working perfectly, and we'd gotten halfway through the show, and it was midnight. And everybody was very uptight, and needless to say, I was twisted into a knot. And all of a sudden, Robin was standing by the piano, and he had a like a drum major's baton in his hand. And he started talking to it. and it started talking back. And in 5 minutes, we were on the floor in hysterics laughing. And I went home that night, and I woke up my wife at about 2 in the morning, and I woke her up and I said, "You will not believe what I have just witnessed." And I said to her, I said, "You know, this kid's going to be something in a few years. Mark my word," and he certainly turned out to be that way.
Oh, my goodness, yes. We have this wonderful clip from Fresh Air, an interview Robin Williams did in 2006 with Terry Gross. And she asked him if he ever got depressed.
Have you ever dealt with depressions? And I guess I'm wondering if
as a human being, yeah.
Yeah, and I guess I'm wondering if, like, your manic side, if your manic side
it's
has...
It's not even manic.
Side.
I mean, manic, that people sometimes... I volunteered to be on the cover of a... I think it was Newsweek for their issue on medication. Thank you. And when the guy said, "Well, you know, do you ever get depressed?" I said, "Yeah, sometimes I get sad." I mean, you can't watch news for more than 3 seconds and go, "Oh, this is depressing." And then immediately all of a sudden they branded me manic depressive. I was like, that's clinical. I'm not that. Mm-hmm. Do I perform sometimes in a manic style? Yes. Am I manic all the time? No. Do I get sad? Oh, yeah. Does it hit me hard? Oh, yeah. Do you find a way, but does that immediately make me like, "Oh, good. Thanks, Terry. Nice talking with you. Oh, I don't know, Terry. I don't know. I don't get, I'm okay. Give me that. Can I borrow that? Oh, no. I'm all right. Thanks for asking that, Terry, because, yeah, I get depressed. I get depressed that I wasn't on American Idol." I could say.
Oh, my God. It's so funny and so sad at the same time. You know, I guess, Jeff Bolt, it's worth saying that, you know, great comedy often comes from great pain. It is. We're not talking necessarily about the clinical condition, but that's kind of there's sadness where there's joy.
Well, I think Robin was in tune with the human condition. I think he really, and all aspects of it, and a lot of that tragedy plus time equals comedy. And I think he had a tragedy in his life. I think he was an only child. I think he had a stepbrother, but I'm talking to him about playing for hours and hours and hours with his army, his army men, and all by himself. And I think those conversations that he had with that spear that pulled came out of some of that. He had the conversations. The army men talked to each other, and they had conversations, and those were. That's probably where he picked up a lot of that skill of just creating those imaginary friends and creatures. And he had a great collection. He was an avid collector of army men and army stuff and toys and everything. His house was a museum of all the stuff that he collected from his childhood. So a lot of that carried over onto the stage. I'm not sure whether how depressed he really was at the end. I have to wait till the story comes out. But he was probably it seemed a little. The last time I saw him, he was quieter and more subdued. But he was so happy to be home from. I think he was in Vancouver shooting the museum, the third Teddy Roosevelt. The role of Teddy Roosevelt in the Night at the Museum 3 or 4 or 7 or 8 or whatever it is. And he loved it here so much. So for all his sadness everyone talks about, he was just so elated to be back home in Marin with his lovely wife, Susan, who I just feel so sad for, but and his family and whatnot. But it's just such a tragedy that... through all this that he'd just been through, to finally get back to the peace and quiet of his home and loving family and friends. So I'm babbling, I know, but
it mirrors so what we're shock. All feeling right now, which, as you say, is shock. Laura in Los Altos writes, "His death doesn't seem real. I keep waiting for him to make a wisecrack about it. His silence is just not right."
He will be missed so greatly, and he was so, you know, not too many have talked about how magnanimous he was and just his generosity and his giving, and I think he was to charities and to different causes of all types, including, you know, traveling overseas to Afghanistan and Iraq and soldiers, but just locally, and his contributions that he made silently, quietly, without anyone knowing, without... mentioning his name and whatnot. I was going to go bike riding with him not too long ago. We talked about an avid bike rider up here in Marin, and I mentioned I didn't have a road bike, a mountain bike, but I don't have a road bike. He said, well, come on, just take one of mine. You know, he had a collection of
50 bikes, right?
It's crazy, yeah, and just take one. You know, we'll find one that fits and we'll go. He was just so generous, not just to other performers and comedians, but to all kinds of causes, and maybe that'll come out somewhere in down the road. But
yeah.
He was just very, very generous and giving guy.
We're getting a lot of stories like that from our listeners. Mike writes, I met him once. He spoke at the Center for Independent Living in Berkeley a long time ago. He greeted people at the door. Smart move, because it gave us all access to him. He donated his time to do the Peter and the Wolf narration with the SF Youth Symphony. I'm so sorry to learn that he suffered. He brought joy to us all. Monty writes, I'm not usually a celebrity chaser, but I'm feeling it like everybody else today in such a personal way, because underneath his show, what came through was through with Robin was his heart. I ran into him one day in Marin, where my daughter and I were just walking our dogs. He stopped to pet our dogs, and then he went into his voices and his accents, having conversations with each of the dogs. He was just a warm and friendly guy. My heart is sad that we couldn't have given him back the faith in life he gave us. And, you know, I don't know, this is making me think of his role in Good Will Hunting, how inspirational he was to that young cohort, and in a sense to all of us, reminding us about the passion with which we should live life and appreciate art and literature.
I ask you about love, probably quote me a sonnet. But you've never looked at a woman and been totally vulnerable. Known someone that could level you with her eyes. Feeling like God put an angel on earth just for you. Who could rescue you from the depths of hell. And you wouldn't know what it's like to be her angel. To have that love for her be there forever. Through anything. Through cancer. And you would know about sleeping, sitting up in a hospital room for 2 months, holding her hand, because the doctors could see in your eyes that the terms visiting hours don't apply to you. You don't know about real loss, because that only occurs when you love something more than you love yourself. I doubt you've ever dared to love anybody that much.
You know, he's playing a psychiatrist, Willa Paskin, and boy, I guess, yeah, maybe inside every comedian there is a psychiatrist, but he was particularly good at that.
Well, he actually played a lot of roles where he played someone who was particularly attuned to the pain of others, especially children. I mean, there's Dead Poets Society. He played Peter Pan in Hook. He played an overgrown boy in Jack. You know, he played a father who sort of connects with his kids in Jumanji and Mrs. Doubtfire. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, for all of his high energy and sort of anticness of his performances, there was often an innocence in them, sort of like a childlike, kind of just that childlike energy and, you know, that the grown-ups don't have and that he really had. And the Good Will Hunting performance is interesting because it's sort of one of his most tamped down but also sweet. You know, he played a lot of villains in his life, and those were often, he would get extremely quiet. But the Good Will Hunting is obviously part, he's obviously playing not at all a villain, he's playing a really helpful and heroic man who sort of had the gravitas and the soothingness of like a father figure.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting to note too, yeah, going from a young manic ping pong ball to a father figure who at the same time is still quite funny. Jeff Bolt, I'm wondering if you can just talk about the way his stand-up evolved over the years, because he was funny in all ways, but it really was very different from one end to the other.
Yeah, you try to ask people what was one of your favorite Robin Williams jokes, and I don't think anybody can tell you one, because he wasn't a joke teller per se. He was. It was the process that was so fascinating to watch. He'd get on stage and he'd start somewhere and end up way, way, way over here as a munchkin or of course, his voices were scattered throughout, all his wacky voices and stuff. But there was no, you can't really quote him. Nobody can copy him. Nobody can steal him. You can mimic him, I suppose. But
bits and pieces only.
Tiny bits and pieces, and it was just great to watch his set evolve. His sets were designed, you know, his movies were for kids and for people, but his stand-up was really rated R13 at least sometimes.
If not X.
Yeah. I mean, it was pretty... he would go places where most people wouldn't go normally on a stage and get away with it and make it funny and make it hysterical. And he could be naughty, dirty, and still you'd walk out of there going, that's the best stand-up set I've ever seen in my life. It's just amazing to watch the process. And I think what Bob was alluding to earlier, it has evolved over the years much more... it's much more contained, much more not rehearsed, but just much more kind of subdued, I guess, in a way.
Subdued in comparison to what he used to be like.
Right, right.
Which is, you know, such a high-octane level of performance that maybe it was just inevitable.
But back to the point also about the dogs and the kids. I mean, if you were having a party, I don't... Robin would go if he wasn't guaranteed there's going to be at least one dog there and several kids. He had much, much more comfortable, I think.
And a big heart. Jeff Bolt, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Also, Willa Paskin, James Dunn, and earlier Bob Sarlat and Leonard Maltin. You've been listening to Forum, and we're going to be back in just a moment. I'm Rachel Miro.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.